us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern in Studio B at Revolution.radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
Your body's filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not. Your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. Your neurobiological system is telling it to run. But your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
Listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
They can be a bit of inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out of here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
You bunch of a-holes.
Where are you going to go? Where are you going to run? Where are you going to hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention?
Your systems are all gone.
Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough for life.
Central, 404 Mountain, 304 West Coast, 604 East Coast. Good evening, Iceland. Happy Friday, Australia. Well, kids, you heard it here on Monday. You heard it here on Monday. On the award-winning, but yet to be nominated, this, that, and the other. Heard every Monday and Thursday here on Revolution Radio, located at revolution.radio. Common spelling in your favorite internet browser. You heard it here first, kids. The link in the chat room from marca.com. It has been said, it was said, a time traveler predicted our future today, that aliens will conquer Earth. Here's the issue. What time zone? It's Australian time zone. It's tomorrow. If it's East, Central, Mountain, Pacific, it's still the 23rd. If you care, this is a link to the Chinese-owned TikTok webpage where you can apparently view this person's predictions in the 2,941 comments. I do not have a TikTok account, nor will I ever have one. I have no social media with the exception of a double top secret Twitter account where I troll people. I've been very open about that. I guess you could say I technically have a double top secret YouTube page too that I troll people, but I'm only active on it when I'm actively trolling. But again, I mean, look, somebody writes, they figured it out. He's using a galactic calendar, not an Earth calendar. Tactically, this time traveler's predictions are correct, just the wrong calendar. I mean, this folk dude has predicted everything under the sun. 8,000 people are going to be chosen to save humanity by an alien known as the Champion. The Champion apparently was going to bring those people to a habitable planet to save the species from another hostile entity. Back on the 15th of May, 2023, you can read these at the link I provided. Click on the link. Click on the link, bruh. May 5th, I'm reading it from the link from a Radiant Time Traveler. There is a lot you need to know. May 15th of this year, a 750-foot mega tsunami will hit San Francisco, California, with over 200,000 casualties. I wonder if this person watched that M. Night Shyamalan latest movie, Knock at the Door, where basically these four folks show up, and they're the four horsemen, and they walk in and go, look, you've got to choose who's going to die. We can't do it for you. And if you don't, there's going to be some situations. So that tsunami apparently is coming on May the 15th this year. On June the 12th of this year, if the tsunami is not bad enough killing 200,000 people, a five-mile deep trench opens from a 9.5 magnitude earthquake, releasing many species thought to be extinct. Well, got that to look forward to. That's happening in June of this, I believe. What else we got going to this time travel? Staying in the month of June, on the 18th, seven people randomly fall from the sky to their passing while nothing was even there. There was. Even, what? Oh, they just randomly fall from the sky. August, I presume finishing out the summer, scientists create a cure for lung and skin cancer, so there's some good news, using a pituitary gland from a squirrel. I wonder if they've tried that already. So that's interesting. If we make it through the tsunami in June, the 9.5 magnitude earthquake that opens up a trench 5 miles deep, releasing a large number of extinct critters, and our skin and lung cancer is cured. So as they say in some places, smoke them if you got them. On December 3rd, a large crystal is discovered deep in the Amazon, having the power to heal all ailments and injuries. So if you lost some limbs, if you got into a beatdown session, MMA would go on forever because you just bring this crystal and you get your broken nose. It just immediately heals between rounds. I mean, you would be Wolverine, but slightly different. So that happens in December of this year. Merry Christmas, everybody. Merry Christmas.
Does that wrap up the year? Oh, I'm sorry. Then December 29th, scientists find a way to use stem cells to grow replacement organs and new kinds of organs. But why would you need that if we've got the crystal that heals? What does the crystal do? The crystal, the power to heal all ailments and injuries. I don't know. I guess I would consider. So maybe. Well, wait a minute. This doesn't make any sense. If we've got the pituitary gland from the squirrel curing lung and skin cancer, why would we need stem cells to grow replacement organs? Maybe you have a collapsed lung, maybe a punctured lung. Okay, I see the logic here. That's December 29th of this, allegedly from this time traveler. And I mean, geez, wrapping up, and that wraps up the year, kids. There you go. That wraps up the year. Link in the chat room if you're interested in reviewing what I just read. Nice cat, Flippy. That's how we do things downtown. So it hasn't happened. I'm sorry. Nothing I could do. The aliens didn't come. No one was invaded. Everything seems pretty copacetic. And on that note, let's visit our friends over at Wartime Stories, staying with the alien / UFO theme, where apparently aliens, U.S. soldiers attacked by UFO in North Korea. I mean, this is interesting.
My name is Francis.
U.S. soldiers attacked by
this event
UFO
that I'm about to relate to
in North
is
Korea.
The truth.
I mean, this is interesting.
So help me God. It happened in the early spring of 1951 in the country of Korea. We were in the Army Infantry. I was in the 25th Division, 27th Regiment, 2nd Battalion, Easy Company. We were in what is known on the military maps as the Iron Triangle, near Chorwon. We were to the left of Chorwon, just across the mountain ridge from this city, or town, or whatever you want to call it. It is night. We are located on the slopes of a mountain, between the fingers of a mountain, as they run down toward the valley below, where there is a Korean village to our north. Previously, we had sent men into this village to warn the locals to evacuate, because we were going to bombard it with artillery. On this night that I'm talking about, we had started doing just that. We had aerial artillery bursts coming in and exploding over this village. As the shells are bursting over this town, with the mountains to our backs, we suddenly noticed on our right-hand side what appeared to be a jack-o'-lantern come wafting down across the mountain. And at first, no one thought anything about it. This thing just continued on down to the village where the aerial artillery bursts were exploding. And this thing, it was that quick that it could get right into the center of an airburst of artillery, just from one airburst to another, as if it could predict where the artillery shells were going to be, then move to that spot right when the artillery shell explodes, which should be impossible. And yet, despite moving into the center of these airbursts of artillery, whatever this object was, it remained completely unharmed. The time element on this, I can't recall exactly. I would say we watched this thing for 45 minutes to an hour, all told, that this object hovered over the town in and out of these artillery bursts. But then this object started heading in our direction. It's hard to distinguish the size of it. There's just no way to compare it. But it pulsated. The light, that is, was pulsating. And it turned from an orange to a blue-green brilliant light as it approached us, came to hover right over top of us, maybe 30 or so feet right above our heads. Sir. But as it approached, I asked for and received permission from Lieutenant Evans, our company commander at that time, to fire on this object, which I then did with an M1 rifle with armor-piercing bullets or rounds in it. And I did hit it. Must have been metallic, because you could hear when the projectile slammed into it. Now, why would that bullet damage this craft if the artillery rounds didn't? I don't know. unless they had dropped their protective field around him or whatever. After my first shot, everyone else opened up with everything we had. But after that first shot, nothing would affect it. That one shot got it. That was it. Because evidently their defenses were lowered briefly, and when I connected with it with my round, their defenses were thrown back up. And after that, nothing could hit it. Because even with everything we threw at it, there wasn't another sound like that first shot. Like our bullets just couldn't make contact with the surface anymore. So now, right when my round hit it, the object started going wild. And the light was going on and off, and it went off completely once, briefly. And it was moving erratically from side to side as though it might crash into the ground. And then we heard a sound, which we had heard no sound previous to this. The sound of, like, you know, diesel locomotives revving up. It was a deep sound, like it was winding up, like it was trying to recover from the bullet impact. And then we were attacked. I guess you would call it that. In any event, we were swept by some form of ray that was emitted in pulses, in waves that you could visually see only when it was aiming directly at you. That is to say, like a searchlight sweeps around, and the segments of light, you would see it coming at you. And when this thing hit you, you would feel a burning, tingling sensation all over your body, as though something were penetrating through you. And so the company commander, Lieutenant Evans, hauled us immediately into our bunkers. We didn't know what was going to happen. We were scared. Anyway, these are underground dugouts where you have peepholes to look out to fire at the enemy. So I'm in my bunker with another man. We're peeping out at this thing. It hovered over us for a while, lit up the whole area with its light that I'm telling you about. And then I saw it shoot off at a 45-degree angle. That quick. It was there and was gone. That quick. And it was as though that was the end of it. But 3 days later, the entire company of men had to be evacuated by ambulance. They had to cut roads in there and haul them out. They were too weak to walk. And they had dysentery. And then subsequently, when the doctors did see them, they had an extremely high white blood cell count, which the doctors could not account for. In the military, especially the Army, each day you file a report, a company report. Now, we had a confab about that. What do we do about this? Do we file it in the report or not? And the consensus was no, because they'd lock every one of us up and think we were crazy. At that time, no such thing as a UFO had ever been heard of, and we didn't know what it was. And I still don't know what it was. Immediately following their close encounter, Francis and dozens of other men in his unit were reportedly suffering severe headaches, nausea, and dysentery. Vomiting continued for several days. Francis stated that for weeks he experienced a decreased appetite, but with an increased thirst for fluids. These symptoms he describes have been noted as being similar to those seen in victims of radiation poisoning. After recovering from the incident, Francis would ultimately survive the war and return home to North Carolina. He was honorably discharged from the Army the following year, in June of 1952. He explained how he dropped from 180 pounds to 138 pounds after returning home, and stated he had extreme difficulty keeping his weight up after that point. He went on to say even after returning home, throughout his life, he would continue to experience severe and recurring headaches, bad enough to have him sent home from work or to the hospital, but no doctor could evidently explain why. Since the time of the event, he reported experiencing periods of disorientation and memory loss. There was even a period of an entire 3 days that he says he couldn't remember, all of which was said to be noted in his medical records. These additional symptoms are similar to those described by others who have come forward about their own close encounters with these strange objects. In 1987, Francis conducted the interview in which he shared this story with a Mr. John Timmerman, who was project manager for the photo exhibit of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. When asked if he told the story to anyone else before the interview, Francis laughed and said, "Yes, I've told my wife and children. I have related this story to them many times over since coming back from Korea, but you know how it is with things like that." They said, "Uh-huh," and they go on, and that's the end of it. Francis was later contacted by a notable ufologist, Richard F. Haynes, for a follow-up interview that took place on May 10, 1989. All of this information gathered from Francis would then be published several years later in 1990 in Richard Haynes' book, Advanced Aerial Devices Reported During the Korean War. Francis was a veteran of not only the Korean conflict, but also a veteran of World War II, having reached the draft age of 18 in December of 1944, and then serving in the Merchant Marines until the war's end in 1945. Then transitioning to the Army and being sent to fight in Korea only 5 years later, Francis's name, rank, serial number, and other information was confirmed by Richard Haynes to be on the official Army roster for his unit, the 27th Infantry Regiment Wolfhounds. The second lieutenant he mentioned, Del G. Evans, his name and other information was likewise confirmed on the official Army roster for Echo Company. Lieutenant Evans was a notable officer, receiving multiple service medals for valor and heroism and in recognition of his combat and leadership qualities. After the war, Del remained in the military and worked with U.S. Army intelligence. Among other things, he planned, organized, and wrote emergency defense plans for the Army. He retired as a lieutenant colonel in 1970, following 23 years of exemplary service. However, no source I found appears to indicate that Dell ever made any mention of the strange encounter that Francis describes. Dell Evans passed away in 2004, 5 years after Francis. I did attempt to contact Dell's family to ask whether he might have ever mentioned anything about this encounter, but I was unable to reach them for comment. By the time this interview took place, in the fall of 1987, after 36 years, Francis understandably couldn't recall any of the names of the men in his unit that might still be alive to verify his account with their own, other than Second Lieutenant Evans. Francis had moved back to North Carolina after the war, and while many of the men in his unit had died during subsequent battles in Korea, he recalled that many of them were originally from states on the West Coast. He expressed regret about not being able to call up their names, but, as with many soldiers, despite making fast friends in the military, over time they had simply fallen out of touch. Whatever the case, following an extensive dive into the styles and capabilities of both American and Russian aircraft in the early 1950s, Richard Haynes stated that no craft like the one described by Francis is known to have existed. When asked what he thought the object was, Francis answered quite plainly, "An alien spacecraft. Nothing like I had ever seen." "I do believe that these things are real," Francis had stated previous to this, "and I think that there is a cover-up, and we were ordered to say nothing about this." That shows you they are covering it up. It's foolish to believe that we have the only technology anywhere, you know? While there may no longer be any direct witnesses to verify his personal account, Dr. Haynes noted that this close encounter of the first and second kind contains interesting corroborative data to another UFO sighting that is listed in his book. The separate sighting took place on the night of March 10, 1951.
Life.
Anybody got eyes on? What was that flash of light?
Couldn't tell you, sir. It looks like a flare, but where? How high are we right now, sir?
17,000 feet. What the hell is that, Eddie?
It's like a ball of light, sir. And, sir...
What's that, Eddie?
Never mind, sir. I think it's gone.
The chief eyewitness in this case was the left scanner on a B-29 flying at almost 17,000 feet of altitude on a heading of 32 degrees northeast, 42 miles southwest of Chinampo, Korea. Eight of the other crewmen also saw very brief glimpses of this same bright light. The night was described as being clear and moonless. The main witness saw a flash of brilliant light at his 9 o'clock position that moved slightly downward and to the rear of the airplane. Not knowing what it was, the scanner reported it as a flare. The phenomenon appeared as a reddish-yellow glow that dropped slightly to the same elevation of the aircraft, then burst with bluish-white brilliance. It was estimated to be as large as a basketball and did not deviate from its straight course. However, none of the crew could confidently estimate the actual distance on anything except by sheer guess, so the object might have been larger and further away. The tail gunner and bombardier both reported seeing the blue-green or blue-white flash of light off the right wing of the aircraft, but were not at a vantage point to see the object. The pilot witnessed the object at 3 o'clock from the corner of his eye as a flash of blue-white or blue-green. None of the men saw any shape or shadows or anything resembling exhaust traces or anything that would identify this object as an aircraft. This was all according to a United States Air Force Staff Message Division report, number Alpha 5394, dated 26 March 1951. The Air Force listed this case as unidentified in its Blue Book files, with the possibility of it being flak, a flare, or a meteor. Whether the object seen by the B-29 crew on March 10th is the same object that attacked the 27th Regiment at Chorwan is left to our own speculation. But consider that the port city of Chinampo sits about 90 miles west-northwest of Chorwan. Francis reported that when the UFO departed his location, it shot off in an upward direction, heading west. The B-29's location was reported as flying 42 miles southwest of Chinampo. This would mean they were 17,000 feet in the air due west of Chorwan and flying in a direction 30 degrees to the northeast, meaning Francis' position on the ground would have been about 120 miles to the east, off of their right wing. This would reasonably place their aircraft in the western flight path of the rapidly departing UFO. That, and seeing as the object was spotted off the right wing of the plane, and that its size and distance was indeterminable in the dark sky, this would also fit, since they said that the sky was clear, and that the object would have to approach their position from the east, from their right side. And while many accounts of Francis's story incorrectly state that the event took place in May of 1951, the unedited version of Francis' 1987 interview in Richard Haynes' book, it says nothing about the event taking place in the month of May. Francis seems unable to recall the exact date and merely stated that the UFO encounter occurred in the early spring. However, a quick dive into the chronology of the 25th Infantry Division's movements during the war offers us a better estimate of the date his unit would have been in the vicinity of Chorwan, and it was in fact in March. And I quote, "On March 7th, the 25th attacked across the Han and headed north, inflicting heavy casualties on the enemy. By the end of March, the 25th Division held a line above the Han Tan River, south of Chorwan, about 35 miles northeast of Seoul." The unit could not have been in that position in May, because on April 22nd, the Chinese launched another offensive, again pushing the UN forces back south. The 25th Division fell back through successive blocking positions to a line about 5 miles north of Seoul, where it remained through the month of May. So providing that Echo Company's individual movements placed them further to the north during this offensive, the date of March 10th, 1951, would be an acceptable date for Francis to be in the vicinity of Chorwan, the same night that the B-29 crew witnessed the object. To recap, this information does allow for these two individual sightings to take place in conjunction with one another, possibly within the same short period of time, with the B-29 crew witnessing the object as it rocketed westward into the sky, away from its attack on Francis's infantry company. The object first presenting with an orange light, or reddish-yellow, and then changing to bluish-white light, this also matches in both cases. This, of course, is only speculation based on the available information, but whatever these objects were, if they were not the same object seen on the same night, or even on different nights, then that would mean that there were two separate but identical objects being reported. And these two sightings are not alone. Indeed, the sheer number of documented UFO sightings during the Korean War is remarkable. Between September of 1950 till the winter of 1954, more than 63 military pilots, soldiers, ground radar operators, naval personnel, and others reported sighting more than 40 UFOs in the skies over Korea. With the war lasting just over 3 years, that amounts to at least one UFO sighting every month. And how many soldiers saw something similar, but never bothered reporting it? Along with events back home in the States, such as the Mantell UFO incident and other UFO sightings over American military bases around the time of World War II, it does seem the number of UFO reports by the U.S. military during the war in Korea are possibly what prompted the U.S. government to seriously investigate these sorts of incidents in an effort to evaluate what might amount to a potential military threat. The U.S. Air Force established the highly classified Project Blue Book in March of 1952. Francis is certainly not alone in his belief that the large majority of these reported events have long been concealed from the public. His comments about this were made in 1987, and 30 years later, recent disclosures of military secrets about UFOs certainly do nothing to disprove his and others' long-held suspicions. A BBC article written in January 2023 pointed out that newly declassified U.S. government documents are revealing that sightings and reports of UFOs, or UAPs, by hundreds of U.S. service members means that these are hardly an unusual occurrence. Although some among the more than 40 reported UFO sightings over Korea are as remarkable as Private Walls, and these will have to be covered in future episodes, none of them appear to have been nearly as close in kind, nor do they offer the unique details that his close encounter does. However, and for me this is where the story gets creepy, a practically identical object was seen again 30 years later by multiple police officers on the Columbia River just north of Portland, Oregon.
This feels so ADT right. Systems now feature Google.
In the early hours of a cold, misty morning on March 17, 1981, St. Helens Police Department Sergeant Russell Yoakum reported a close encounter of the first kind. At 4:03 a.m., Yoakum was patrolling Highway 30 west of the Columbia River when he spotted a bright light moving in an easterly direction toward the Portland Airport upriver. While aircraft were known to regularly pass over the area on the way to the airport, he noted that the light was unusually bright, so much that it lit up the river like the sun was just coming up, like the whole area around the object was in broad daylight. "I thought it was an aircraft landing light, but it was brighter than a normal landing light would be," Yoakum told the National Enquirer in 1981. Convinced that the light was not an aircraft, Yoakum radioed headquarters and then headed to the county courthouse to view the unidentified flying object from the banks of the Columbia River. A few local citizens and two Oregon State Police officers, Ricky Cade and Tom McCartney, joined him there, and Yoakum got in contact with a man named Donald Askins via CB radio. Askins lived in a home across the river in Ridgeland, Washington, and went by the handle Lucky 13. He could not only see the light, but hear it, too. Askins reported an eerie and extremely loud noise that sounded like a power plant diesel motor and a screeching noise in between. Baffled, the officer set up a portable tape recorder 18 inches from their police radio to record their conversation with Askins and to catch the sound if it happened again. Askins offered to dangle his CB microphone out of the window of his home so he could transmit the sound, and the police drove to a nearby bluff that gave them a better view. And here is that tape recording.
"You're lucky. So we got a tape recorder sitting there by our radio whenever you're ready. You know, we'll keep it running if the person can just get up and we'll record a little bit of it."
"Down. Just didn't want to think we all have screw loose. Stop. All go to bed.
Yes, all it is now is just an orange glow. That's all I can see."
"Okay, that's all you can see from that?
You guys still Better not be. It's awful early. Awful early for the sun to appear for July. I don't think the sun would just be in that one spot. I think it's low without you guys.
At approximately 4:29 a.m., the light, this object, then began emitting the strange sound again. At 4:43 a.m., having now been surrounded by a thick fog that had rolled in over the river, the bright orange light suddenly went out. One officer said that the light made a funny whistling sound before it went out. Then it sounded as if it went up and away, McCartney recalled to the Inquirer, and within 30 seconds the fog separated and there was now a blue sky shining through. It was eerie. During the event, the Coast Guard was contacted by the state police and confirmed they did have the object on their radar. Sergeant Yoakum's department had likewise contacted the Portland airport, who first confirmed seeing the object on their radar. But within 5 minutes, the airport mysteriously called the police station back and denied it. Dr. J. Allen Hynek later had the tape recording analyzed at his Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, Illinois, and stated that the acoustical experts reported it was unlike any sound they had ever heard like that in nature, and that it was certainly not a helicopter. Whatever the noise was, is it not eerily familiar to the description of a diesel locomotive revving up offered by Francis from his close encounter in Korea? An encounter that took place 30 years earlier, and strangely, on nearly the exact same date in March.
Sounds like to me a power plant diesel motor and a screeching noise in between it there earlier with it.
GoDaddy is a partner that always puts you first.
Francis Wall retired in 1969 at the relatively young age of just 42. His daughter, Renee Denny, stated that he spent the next 30 years out of work, struggling with the after effects of the war, what was overlooked then but would likely be diagnosed now as a form of PTSD. He was especially affected by the sounds of airplanes and once knocked his own mother and sister to the ground after mistaking them for enemy troops. "I guess he would have flashbacks," his daughter said. Recounting one of his other stories from the war, she explained that one night he managed to make his way through a pitch-dark minefield, praying for his life as he went. Some among his fellow soldiers were not as fortunate. A sudden explosion, the sound of screaming. "When he went into the army," his daughter said, "he was happy-go-lucky, just a totally different person to when he came out." Over the years, his daughter continued, he would tell and retell the tale of his strange UFO sighting. The story was always the same. It never changed through the years. Perhaps not unlike his other traumatic experiences, Francis's recollections of the UFO sighting remained very consistent and acute. The summation of these vivid memories from Korea were nonetheless a tragic burden on Francis's mind until his passing in 1999. If his story is true, skeptics can only reason that what Francis witnessed might have been a severe hallucination brought on by the fog of war, the mental stress that occurs when soldiers are engaged in violent combat and experience an overwhelming feeling of uncertainty, like a fog. That seems a paltry explanation for such a vivid experience that Francis describes, but that is why these kinds of stories were selected to fall under the heading of The Fog of War, being reminiscent of a Twilight Zone level of paranormal encounters. And even many among those Twilight Zone stories written by Rod Serling were inspired by his own combat experience and the terrible things he witnessed as an American paratrooper fighting in the Philippines during World War II. But unlike Rod Serling's cleverly written dramas, these Fog of War stories are not intended to be considered works of fiction, whether we find them believable or not. Those who have had their stories shared on this channel, like Francis, have insisted that they are true encounters. With UFOs, many sightings do often appear to amount to cases of mistaken identity, even under the calmest of circumstances, far removed from the psychological stresses of combat. Perhaps a balloon, an insect, a cloud, a drone, or passing aircraft. But whatever Francis saw that night, at such close range, as well as the dozens of other military personnel during the war in Korea who reported similar objects, can we so easily dismiss them all as liars or delusional men suffering from the same identical hallucinations? As Francis indicated, reporting these sorts of strange and unbelievable encounters has long done more harm than good, and can certainly ruin both a man's reputation and his career in the military. How many more men and women have subsequently remained silent about what they saw? But even with verified military sightings and other such reports of these truly bizarre objects dating back decades, or perhaps hundreds or even thousands of years, depending on our historical interpretations, most unfortunately, the true nature of these objects and their exact origin only continues to elude us.
And thank you to our friends over at, Wartime Stories, or friend, since it's Wes, over at Wartime Stories. In the chat room, I provided the link to the channel. That's not Wes. I mean, the channel of Wartime Stories. Not an endorsement, just simply information in sourcing the material where the material needs to be sourced. So looking out the window, I don't see any UFOs or anything. I mean, it's 5:43 Central Time. So, you know, who knows? Who knows? Who knows? So I tend to think I know a bit about serial killers, but there are even some things your humble host has to look up. Not an endorsement, but one of the paid streaming channels had on a movie, The Boston Strangler. Now, I've seen the Tony Curtis, but 90% of the Tony Curtis movie went from 1968 or 7, shortly after DeSalvo was arrested. That was a movie of its time. If you have not seen The Boston Strangler starring Tony Curtis, was it 1967? Let me check the old internets. Was it 67 or 68? 68. Sorry, 68. Tony Curtis was in there. Henry Fonda, George Kennedy. Karen Hudson was in there. I mean, that was a classic movie. Long story short, so they pulled out a new version, and I thought, okay, let me look into this. Fact or fiction? What'd they get right? What'd they get wrong? And this is what I think you should understand. 99.9% of the movie, directed by and written by Matt Ruskin, I mean, a high percentage of the movie is historically accurate. This dude, Matt Ruskin, not only went online and read the original newspaper articles, but even went as far, my fine feathered friends, went as far as to speak to the living relatives of why am I blanking on living relatives of Loretta McLaughlin and Gene Cole. Now, Loretta McLaughlin and Gene Cole, if you did not know, were two women that in the movie it says they started working together in about 65 or so. No, actually, they started working together in 1952. But the two women that started writing the series on these mysterious women that were being – these women who were being strangled, and the two women found a connection and are rightfully credited with naming the Boston Strangler, the Boston Strangler. And in some of the voiceovers in the movie, Keira Knightley, who plays the now departed Loretta McLaughlin, she's actually narrating the word for word the stories that were printed, and you can find those them online if you want to. I think it's a hell of a movie. Yeah, because of condensing time, they've got to, you know, speed up some things. You know, there's a character, Detective Conley, who's technically a composite of a number of detectives that worked on the case. As I mentioned, the two women, Jean and Loretta, started working on the stories together in 62. Or started working together in 62. Technically, they started working together a decade earlier in 52. The author takes a little bit of, the director takes a little bit of creative license where he has DeSalvo calling Loretta and says, look, come visit me the next day to hear his side of the story. Because if you don't know, if you would go back and listen to the confession, it almost sounds as if the police detective is feeding information to DeSalvo. And the movie takes the position that, yeah, DeSalvo may have been eventually, through DNA, linked to 13 of the victims. There are still 12 victims, but those crimes have not been solved. And some think maybe maybe Nasser was involved. Maybe a gentleman that they refer to as Daniel Marsh. Technically, that's a pseudonym. It was given to the suspect in the case, but that person's identity has never been made public, which is very interesting. There's a suspect referred to as David Parker by some of the media. But the Daniel Marsh individual was in fact a former Harvard student who in fact did have a history of domestic abuse, who had moved to Michigan before copycat murders took place in Michigan. But in the film they refer to this person as Daniel Marsh and does not mention any other suspects. There's also an individual by the name of Nasser in there who at the end, it was still currently still life in prison out in Massachusetts and basically says, look, I'm serving a life sentence. Why would I lie to you? I don't kill women. And part of the idea is Nasser and then this other individual that they referred to as Daniel Marsh served time with DeSalvo when he was at the psychiatric hospital, and they coached him on the facts of some of the previous cases. But so there's a little bit of creative license, but overall, man, it's good. And I had thought I knew some things about some things, but I didn't know honestly who coined the term the Boston Strangler. I had no idea that these two women were so pivotal in the reporting of DeSalvo. If you don't know, again, in the movie they mention DeSalvo calls Loretta. No, DeSalvo actually called his psychiatrist, Dr. Amos Roby. And that call took place the day before DeSalvo was shivved, shanked, murdered in the state hospital shortly that night. So, as they say, dead man tell no lies. But later on, they did exhume the bodies of the victims and did trace 13 of the victims to DeSalvo. But again, victims range from 1 to 13, and some still believe that there were other individuals involved. I mean, again, serial killing isn't necessarily it's not a science, it's not factual. And some of the things that led people to believe there was more than one was, first, the age range. I mean, the victims, the 13 single women, between the ages of 19 and 85, I mean, that's a huge range of women. And this took place between 62 and 64, from month to month, less than a two-year period. Yeah, but again, DeSalvo initially confessed to George Nassar, and then F. Lee Bailey was hired, and F. Lee Bailey took on the case. There were some inconsistencies, but part of it was DeSalvo did cite some details that were not made to the public. But again, no physical evidence to substantiate his confession. DeSalvo's mental state, if you don't know, was evaluated by a neurologist. I blank on the guy's name. F. Lee Bailey arranged for a plea bargain in order to lock in his client's guilt in exchange for taking death penalty off the table. This is how it works. And if you didn't know, back in 2013, a decade ago, Boston law enforcement had announced that DNA evidence had linked DeSalvo to the rape and murder of 19-year-old Mary Sullivan. They exhumed DeSalvo's remains. And on the 19th of July, it was announced that the DNA results from DeSalvo proved that he was the source of seminal fluid recovered at the scene of Sullivan's 1964 murder. And again, there are some controversies. Though DeSalvo was conclusively linked to Mary Sullivan's murder, people have their doubts on whether or not he committed all the Boston Strangler homicides. Part of it is that, as I mentioned earlier, the inconsistent MO. So it's interesting. I've always said, look, if you're gonna be a serial killer, don't stick to a pattern, which is hard for psychopaths to do. Don't keep any keepsakes, which is hard for a psychopath to do. Don't kill around where you live, which again is hard for a psychopath to do. And have a variety of ways of taking people out, which again is hard for a psychopath to do. It's just difficult. Next hour, we've got Wes again over at Sasquatch Chronicles, a new one. I didn't know this. One final disturbing note on sticking with the movie Hollywood theme. I had no clue that Judy Garland was groped by munchkins. I heard about this and I had no clue it was true. Link in the chat room. This from the Sun just summarizes. I knew that she was, she was on barbiturates or some sort of other medication to keep her body at a certain weight. And she was, pills to fall asleep, pills to wake up, kind of like Elvis. But apparently, she was groped by some of these munchkins, which is quite sad. She was often groped by male actors playing munchkins during the making of the movie, Wizard of Oz, according to the third of her five husbands, Sidney Luft, wrote memoirs. The men were 40 years of age or older. And it wasn't just her co-stars who were sexually abused by. In a biography, it was revealed that teenage starlet was repeatedly propositioned for sex by executives at film studio MGM. Studio boss Louis B. Mayer would compliment Garland's voice by putting his hand on her left breast, pretending to touch her heart, which is where he said she sang from. She eventually told him to stop his creepy advances, and according to the biographer, Mayer cried and said he loved her. Oh my gosh. There's the top of the hour music, and on that note, we'll take a break. Next hour, Sasquatch Chronicles, the helicopter incident.
If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays? For Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
There have been imaginative science fiction writers for generations.
Be invasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
Now, you know, I'm aware of some archaeologists that have uncovered large bones indicating giants in Virginia. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford. Join me every Thursday night in Studio A at 6 p.m. Eastern for Factor Theory Live. Find us on www.revolution.radio. Great guests and great stories.
What do you believe?
Join me in the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is Advanced Ancient Global Civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
It looked like somebody was bent over and had their head in the window of the deer blind, and it either heard me or smelled me, and he pulled his head out of the tent and stood straight up, and that shocked me. They don't make people their head that big.
The way it moved, almost as if it was gliding across the beach. I've never seen anything move like that in my life. They were screaming at each other in gibberish. It sounded like a language, and they were chuntering away back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I know what a bear looks like, and there is no way on this planet that what I saw were bears.
What are you reporting?
Jesus Christ, you better...
Turn.
Deal.
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him. Uh-oh.
This is Carla from the Great Smoky Mountains, and you're listening to the best part of my week, Sasquatch Chronicles.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks for being here tonight. Got a great show planned for you. We're going to be chatting with Joy. And Joy comes to us from Michigan. And in the mid-70s, her and her sister had an encounter with a creature. We're going back over 40 years ago. I'll let Joy go into it. We're also going to be chatting with Amy and James. And Amy and James are long-haul truck drivers. And they had this really bizarre incident that happened to them as they were coming into Minnesota, and I asked them to share it. I don't know if it's Bigfoot related or not, but it's such a bizarre experience. I asked if they would share it. We're also going to be talking with them about a cabin they're having built in Missouri, and they've got some cool pictures, some cool footprints that they captured, and I'll be posting those underneath this episode. If you've had an encounter and you'd like to be on the show, shoot me an email. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. And if you get a chance to check out sasquatchchronicles.com, you can become a member and get additional shows. Let's jump into it tonight. I want to welcome Joy to the show. Joy, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I know that you and your sister had an encounter in Michigan. We're going back to the mid-70s. If you would, take me back to that day. What were you guys doing, and what happened? What did you guys end up seeing?
Sure, sure. So in the 70s, I have a twin sister, and we were always outside playing, you know, playing together. And we were on our gravel road in Grand Haven, Michigan, 1970s. I feel like it was spring or summer because the sun was shining, and I had my bike with me. So I was likely practicing riding my bike. I probably just learned it. And my sister didn't care to learn how to ride a bike until many years later. So we always hung around together. And like most kids in the 70s, our parents weren't around. You know, we were just kind of hanging around with our dogs. We had two huge Labrador dogs with us at the time. So I remember riding past my dogs who were to the right of me in the ditch. And the ditches in along this road were quite deep, probably a foot and a half deep. They started barking, and they started barking like, not like they saw a rabbit or, you know, like an ant, you know, like something that they're used to seeing. They started barking like they were defending us. So it was a very vicious type of bark. So I jumped off my bike, and I quickly ran down into the ditch, and I grabbed their collars. And then I looked up expecting to see someone on their bicycle or, you know, someone running. And what I saw was a bit shocking. I saw a Bigfoot, and at the time I was too young to really, I didn't know the term Bigfoot at the time. So my sister and I were both screaming like a hairy monster, but we saw this hairy, monster step out of the woods in front of us. And our road was a gravel road, but it had a little bit of a hill, and this monster was walking across the hill from the right side to the left side. We were in total shock at first. And it walked maybe two steps, and it was in the middle of the road. It paused, and then it turned towards us. And when it turned towards us, I thought, oh, you know, it's going to come our way. Because the head didn't turn its head. It turned its whole entire torso to look at us. And so, you know, in my mind, as a 7-year-old, I was very concerned at that point. It must have seen us not as much of a threat. It was about 200 feet away. So it was close enough for me to at least see. I didn't see the face, but I saw the hair, you know, the color of the hair and the shape of the head in general. It looked at us for maybe a split second, and then it continued walking. And I very distinctly recall its long arms swinging alongside, just like a human would be swinging their arms and walking. But it was definitely covered head to toe in hair, and the hair was a rust color. And I very vividly recall the color of the hair was a rust with a little bit of gold in it because the sun was shining on it, and it was there, you know, those little remembrances kind of, you know, make their way into your brain. And that's what I remember. I don't remember the facial features at all. I didn't have a great vantage point, where I was a little bit down in the ditch holding my dog's collars for dear life. But yeah, that's all that I remember of the encounter.
What did you think this thing was? I know looking back now, you know, you say Bigfoot, but at the time, what did you think it was?
We called it a hairy monster. I mean, when it disappeared into the woods, you know, we were freaking out, hysterical. And my sister was standing on the road just to the front of me, staring at it as well. So she had a slightly different vantage point than me. But yeah, hairy monster. And I actually, I don't recall running back to get my parents. I recall running to the neighbor's house. So I have a feeling that maybe my parents were being watched by our neighbors, and they just let us kind of do what we needed to do in the 70s, just kind of hanging out outside and playing. But I remember running to my neighbor's house, and these two boys that we hung out quite a bit with knocked on their door, and I said, you know, come quick, there's a hairy monster, you know. And they came in, they came out, we pointed to where it walked into the woods, and I didn't really go up to that part of the road. You know, if we were playing in the road, my parents made it very clear we stayed within you know, right in front of the property, so we're not to go to the corner or anything like that. So there was actually a path in the woods there that I hadn't even known about, but unfortunately, you know, these boys thought it was a joke, and we were screaming like they were going to be killed, you know, anyways, this whole thing. But they played it like it was a complete falsehood, that we didn't see what we saw. And then later, when we went home, or when my parents were talking with us, I remember my mom saying, I think you saw a Bigfoot. And I didn't know what a Bigfoot was. My sister didn't know what a Bigfoot was. And it's not like you can, you know, pop online and pull up a picture, you know. So a few weeks passed, and I recall my mom coming in with a magazine and showing me a picture of a Bigfoot. And both my sister and I were like, yep, that's exactly what we saw. So I guess it was in the news, but it certainly wasn't something that, you know, was an everyday name, you know, of something, right? This is back in, you know, 77. So it wasn't like it was well known. So, I remember those portions of things. I mean, this was 45 years ago. So there's a lot of gaps in, you know, in my recollection. And unfortunately, my mom has passed away. So I can't find out more as an adult what we told her at that time.
Yeah, and I know we're going back many years. And, you know, even though there's not a bunch of TV shows back then, there were a few. But, you know, magazines were big back then. And I know even Bob Gimlin had told me that they had made the cover of several magazines with Patty. I wanted to ask you, I know you guys are 7 or 8 years old at this time, and we're going back so many years, but did you and your sister ever sit down and talk about what you guys saw? Because you were kind of down in the ditch and she's up on the road.
Well, that's the thing, is I don't recollect our talking about it. You know, like, I don't recall afterwards us sitting down and talking about, I'm sure we did, but I just don't recollect what she saw. And as the years moved by, you know, we actually became more interested in paranormal from a ghost perspective and hauntings. So that's really where our focus was. It was never on cryptids. She has a much more creative kind of job. So she delved into, you know, studying Bigfoots and watching all the Bigfoot TV and, you know, that type of thing. So, I mean, to this day, she knows what she saw. I know what I saw. And that was the truth. I can't watch, you know, Finding Bigfoot or any of these shows, because I don't know if I get it. I get a bit frustrated at how certain folks go about looking for a Bigfoot. So I really haven't been focused at all on Bigfoot for many, many years, which is probably why my recollection is clear. She, unfortunately, I spoke with her this morning just because we hadn't chatted about what did you see and what, you know what I mean? We didn't have that, I'm sure we did at the time, like I said, but it's been 45 years. So I asked her what she recollected this morning, and she said it's just like a vague memory. And she's watched so many shows, she's listened to so many podcasts, that she's like, I don't know what was my story and what, you know, what I remember from seeing a TV show or what have you. So that's a bit unfortunate. I was hoping she would give you a different perspective, because she did say that when she saw the face, that it looked like it was a monkey type of face when it turned towards us. I don't recall that feature. You know, I don't recall the features on the face at all. So yeah, we're kind of at a disadvantage from our age and it being so very long ago. And unfortunately, you know, our parents both passed away. And so we can't really tap into that, you know, the adults that were around us at the time.
Yeah, I understand. And it's fair for your sister to say that after so many years, she does remember having kind of a monkey face. And I know some of the details are lost in time and that sort of thing. But one thing I wanted to ask you, how big do you think it was? You know, and I know you're 7, 8 years old at this time, and everyone's dad is a giant at that age. You know, your dad could be like 5'2", and, you know, when you're 7 years old, your dad's a giant. Compared to your father, how big do you think this thing was?
My dad was around 6'3", and this thing was bigger than my dad. And bigger also in the breadth, you know, very, very broad shoulders. It might, you know, it probably helped that he was full of hair, you know, covered with hair. But to me, it looked like a bear, but standing and walking on two legs and swinging its arms. It was sizable. I can't tell you exactly, you know, accurately how big it was, but you know, we definitely called it a monster. So it wasn't small. I do recall that the head wasn't pointed. Like I've seen a lot of photos or, you know, a lot of depictions of Bigfoots over the years. And definitely the one that we saw just had a normal round head. It didn't have a pointed head. That's all. And again, I was also struggling with two big Labrador dogs wanting to go after this thing. So I was a bit distracted as well.
Yeah, thank God you held on to your dogs, because I think it would have been a different situation if those dogs would have went after this thing. And I always love hearing encounters from adults when they recount something from their youth, an encounter that happened many years ago. And I think that children handle encounters better than adults do. They just don't quite have the fear or the anxiety that we do. Maybe they don't realize they can die, you know. Kids seem to handle encounters a lot better. I ask everyone on the show, Joy, what do you think Sasquatch is? And there's no wrong answer because no one knows. But after 45 years of kind of having this incident happen to you and your sister, what do you think these creatures are?
Well, you know, first off, what you just mentioned, I agree. I think as a child, when you're seeing something new, it's like other things that you see new as a child. So it was definitely unique. And I really didn't even, outside of maybe a few mentions over the years, if somebody asked me point blank if I had seen a Bigfoot before, I hadn't really given it too much thought. But until recently, I moved to Tennessee. And I'm in an area of East Tennessee where there have been recent Bigfoot sightings. And that got me interested again, like, okay. And I assumed by now, 45 years later, that somebody would have some great evidence. And there's plenty of evidence. I think a lot of people just poo-poo it. But what got me back into this and why I'm speaking to you, there was a local Norris Lake Facebook page that I belong to. And when I heard about a Norris Lake sighting, I innocently posted, hey, has anyone ever had any Bigfoot sightings on Norris Lake? And, you know, you get 2/3 of the people, commenting, yeah, that was my husband, yeah, my ex-husband. You know what I mean? Funny, you know, satirical commentary. But you get like that 1/3 of people that were like, yeah, my uncle saw, you know. So I think that's what people are dealing with nowadays, is that lack, that the complete disbelief that there could potentially be something out there in the world that that we haven't, you know, gotten great biological evidence on or you know, photo evidence or video evidence. So that's my take on that. As far as what I think Bigfoot is, I think it's changed over the years. When I was a child, I absolutely thought it was an animal, a type of an animal. And I believe that all through, you know, many, many years until very recently. I belong to a paranormal group, and they have some beliefs about Bigfoot being more of a ghost. By ghost, I think they mean, you know, more of an interdimensional type being. They've researched Bigfoot, and they've interviewed people that have encountered Bigfoot, and they were seeing that there were some commonalities. When people were seeing a Bigfoot, they would see maybe a green flash before or after they saw a Bigfoot. I didn't see anything like that. You know, to me, it was like an animal walking out of the woods. But I'm certainly open to what it is. And there's just, you know, what got me, the reason why I sent you the email was the one story about someone running into a Bigfoot carrying an animal in its mouth and then the Bigfoot disappearing. So I think those types of stories kind of get you questioning the world that we live in, you know, the nice, safe, sane, normal world that we live in, right? There's this paranormal slant that I don't think we have a lot of visibility into, except for, you know, these glimpses. So.
Yeah, I agree with you, Joy. I think it's very physical. I think people are running into, you know, a lot of times when people are run out of the woods, they're not being run out of the woods by a ghost or what we think of as a ghost. It's something very physical that is terrifying people. And but there's something not quite right here, in my opinion anyway, with this creature. You bring up a great point. Here we are in 2023, and I can't really say that we're that much farther ahead than we were 45 years ago when this thing walked across this road in front of you and your sister. We have evidence. It's trace evidence, you know, footprints, hair, that sort of thing. But it is strange that we're not that farther ahead. And it really makes me wonder. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on and share this. I know it was a very brief sighting, but you know, it's Michigan and it's in the mid 70s. And I don't know that a lot of people were talking about publicly anyway, Sasquatch being in that area. Many reports today, but I think as it comes out and more people come forward, we'll get a little closer to what the truth is on what this thing is. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And this next experience is very strange. I'm not saying it has anything to do with Bigfoot or Sasquatch, but I had to hear it in person because it's such a bizarre experience that happened to James and Amy. James, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Wes. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I also want to welcome your wife. Amy, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you.
And James, if you would just kind of start from the very beginning. Because this is a very bizarre experience that happened to you guys. I know you guys are long-haul truck drivers, and you guys were on I-94 in Minnesota. Just kind of start from the very beginning and walk me into this whole experience.
Well, I drive a truck, and we were heading up to unload, and it was early in the morning. I believe we were right around Menomonee, Minnesota, right on 94. And it was morning, but the morning traffic was kind of starting to pick up.
All right, I'm only interrupting this because it's pronounced Menomonee, not Minimomi. I'm nitpicking here, but if you're going to tell a story about Bigfoot in Minnesota, get your state, city, names correct.
Up a little bit, so there was some traffic out there. And my wife rides with me all the time, has for years and years, but she started pointing out stuff that was really weird. And the first thing that we saw was a bear, and it was laying, I was in the right-hand lane, and it was laying on the right-hand shoulder, but it was just laying there. There was no blood, no skid marks, no nothing like that, but it wasn't moving. And a bear or any animal is not just going to lay right there, you know, on the shoulder with all these cars passing by. But we didn't really think a whole lot about it. We just kept going. A couple miles up the road, over in the left-hand shoulder, kind of in the median, we saw two or three dairy cows just laying there in on the shoulder, on the in the median, and they were also dead. And but again, there was no blood, no nothing. And we both kind of at that point thought, you know, this is really weird. And we kept driving up the road, and a couple miles up the road, again on the right hand side, there was a handful of deer laying there on the shoulder, also all dead, no blood, no skid marks, no nothing. We, of course, you know, we just thought that was really weird, but we just kept going. We went up and made our delivery. And then when we left, we went down the 94 kind of runs right along the Mississippi River. And when we unloaded, we came down on the west side of the Mississippi River, and it's on a little two-lane highway. Runs through Red Wing, Minnesota, Lake City, Minnesota. And as we were leaving out of Lake City, on this little two-lane highway, my wife had noticed something that was, at first it just looked like a big bird because we were kind of far away from it. But as we got closer, you could tell that it was a helicopter, and it was hovering over the river, like right on the bank. And on that side of the Mississippi, it's a pretty good incline from the actual lake up to the road. I'm not sure how far down it is. It's probably 20, 30 foot, I would guess. But this helicopter was just hovering. And as we got closer to it, a couple things we noticed. Number one, it had a pretty thick cable hanging from the bottom of the helicopter.
Look, I'm not going to be this picky guy here, but I wanted to know something about the geography of Minnesota. 94, does it sort of run alongside the Mississippi? Sure, north of the Twin Cities area. Otherwise, it goes pretty much due east out of the Twin Cities, and then it goes west or northwest up to Fargo. I think he's referring to Highway 61, but again, that near the portion where he's stating in the state of Minnesota runs almost due east and west. The river runs southeast northwest. So I'm not being too picky, but just so you understand kind of how the roads work in the great state of Minnesota.
It was hanging down low enough that we couldn't see anything that was on the end of it because of that, you know, incline into the river. And then the next thing we noticed is the helicopter. It was a small one, like a little two-person helicopter, but it was all black. Even the windows were black. The windshield was black. Everything was black. And there was no markings on it. And I'm not much of an aviation expert or anything, but my knowledge is pretty much every aircraft, helicopter, whatever, has some sort of markings on it, or has to even, but this one had nothing. So we kind of slowed down a little bit. It was still fairly early, so there wasn't really any traffic. So we slowed down and we were kind of watching it in our mirrors. My wife was watching it more than I was because I was kind of watching the road. Well, she noticed that it was struggling to get, the helicopter was struggling to lift, and you could tell it was trying to lift, but it was struggling. And at first we thought, well, maybe the cable, you know, they got it hung up on something or whatever. Well, we kept watching it, and then she noticed that it did finally raise up, and it had what looked to be a big bag. She says probably about the size of like an old Volkswagen Beetle, and it was just a white bag hanging from the end of that cable. And so we slowed down even more. Finally, we got kind of out of range where we couldn't really see it too much in our mirrors anymore. And we started talking about it. We just thought it was, you know, really kind of strange. We got down the road a little bit more, and both of us at the exact same time got a text message on our phones And they were both from block numbers, and they both said, we need to talk to you right now. Her and I both just deleted it and just kept on going.
Nobody sent you a text message saying, we got to talk to you, and then let you go on your merry way. Come on, man. Nobody sent you a text message. We need to talk to you and just let you keep on going. At minimum, driving a rig, an 18-wheeler, you would have been pulled over by a trooper for some sort of routine inspection. Nobody sent you a text message saying, we need to talk to you. I don't believe this at all. Not at all.
Never look back.
Yeah, that's a weird sequence of events. Amy, let me ask you, because I know James is driving and you're in the passenger seat and you're kind of watching all of this, and I'm curious about what you saw. I mean, you guys are seeing these dead animals one after another. There's no blood. It doesn't appear they got hit by anything. It's weird, right?
It is. You see cows and deer all the time that get hit. But a bear, that it was like curled up in the ditch like it was sleeping. And I'm not like a kind of an outdoorsy type person, but I'm not a hunter or anything. But common knowledge to me would be that a bear is not just going to lay there in the road ditch with traffic going by. And this is first thing in the morning, so it is light, you know, and you got morning traffic and stuff like that, probably about 6:30 in the morning. And it's just curled up in a ball. And you know, the strange thing is that there was no tire marks. There was no blood. Why would these animals just be dead and just laying there and in such a close area? And so that to me was really, really strange, but I just kind of like, oh, well, that's kind of weird, you know?
Yeah, it's very strange. Tell me about this helicopter that you saw, because, again, James is driving and you're watching all of this. Is it a large helicopter?
No. It looked like, to me, like one of those two-person helicopters where it was small and it was kind of rounded. You know, the larger helicopters have more of a roundish square body. But the smaller ones are more rounded, and it had no mark. You know how helicopters and planes and stuff have the identification numbers on the tail of it? There weren't any. There's no identification on this helicopter. It was all black. You couldn't see anybody in it. I'm not a helicopter expert, but, you know, I know that they have those identification numbers and letters or whatever on the tail end, and I have no idea. Come to think of it, I didn't even see any, you know how helicopters have the lights and stuff on it? I didn't even see any of that.
Yeah, so tell me, when you saw it, it looked like it was trying to lift something up. Just kind of go into what you ended up seeing that day.
Okay, so the helicopter was hovering right at the bank of the Mississippi River, and it had a cable coming down off the bottom of it, and it looked like it would like try to come up a few feet and then come back down a little bit, like it was having a hard time picking up whatever it was hooked to. And when it did finally raise up, it had this big white, it looked like a big white bag, and it was shaped like, you know, like a teardrop. So if it's shaped like a teardrop, you know that it had to have been some kind of not a hard container, but to me, it looked like it would be like the size of a Ford Ranger, a small vehicle. It was that big, and the helicopter finally got it up above where you could just, and after I saw it pick up that white bag or whatever, I'm like, wow, that's weird. I didn't see where it went after that because we just kept going down the road.
Yeah, and I don't have a clue what in the world the helicopter was doing. What's weird is you guys got text messages both at the same time?
Yeah. Yeah, we at the same time our phones went off after we had gone down the road a little bit, and it was from a restricted number, blocked number, I don't remember which, but there was no phone number on it. But it said we need to speak to you. And as soon as we got that text message, I looked at him and he looked at me and I'm like, yeah, nope, delete. I have heard many, many stories about, you know, Sasquatch or Dogman or, you know, whatever, where people have had strange experiences happen to them after they've had an eyewitness account of these creatures. And so, you know, right then and there, I'm just like, yep, not dealing with it.
Yeah, it's hard to say if it's Sasquatch related or not. Just the whole experience is bizarre, especially you guys getting the text messages and then seeing the dead animals and then this helicopter that appears to be lifting something out of the forest. James, I know that you don't know and I don't know. What in the world do you think was going on there? I mean, what's your opinion?
I do believe, you know, I don't know if it was Sasquatch related, Dogman related, something, but to me, it was something cryptid. It was something we weren't supposed to know about. And the only reason I say that is because of the text message. You know, if it was something that they didn't care for us seeing, they wouldn't have cared. A couple little things that I didn't tell you about, we ended up looking at a map afterwards, and like I was telling you, 94 kind of runs up the east side of the Mississippi, and 61, the highway we were on when we saw the helicopter, is on the west side. Well, we looked at a map, and it's 64 miles exactly straight west of where we saw the animals on 94. And the other thing I forgot to tell you, which I remember while you were talking to her, after we passed it, right before we got the text messages, there's a little bitty gas station right there on the side of the highway, and there was four or five black SUVs sitting there, and they had no plates on them. And I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not, but it just kind of, to me, everything by itself probably means absolutely nothing, but when you look at everything together, it's really, really strange. And I do think it was something cryptid. I mean, if it wouldn't have been for the text messages, it wouldn't have been for the SUVs, it wouldn't have been for the animals we've seen, I probably would have just thought, you know, they're picking up trash out of the river, or who knows what. But tying it all together, it seems something, like you said, either cryptid or something, maybe even darker. We don't know.
Yeah, it's weird for sure, and I do appreciate you guys sharing it. I wish I had a great answer for you on what was going on there. Just so many weird things. It's hard to say what was going on, but it's one of those situations where you want to know what's going on, but maybe you don't want to know what's going on, you know? You had sent me this footprint, and I know you guys are building a cabin near the Mark Twain National Forest. And I'll post a picture of this footprint, but tell me about this cabin and some of the things going on out there.
Well, we bought the property almost exactly 3 years ago. It's actually not in the Mark Twain. It's actually just right on the outskirts of Mark Twain. And it's kind of down in a little valley right on a lake. And it's in Missouri, but they consider it mountains. But it's kind of mountains all the way around, so it kind of sits down in this little valley. And it's all forest. Like I said, we bought this property right at 3 years ago, and we bought it so we could, we're about to retire, so we wanted kind of our own little place to just get away from everything. So we bought this, it's basically a prefab cabin, but it's just the shell, and we have to just do everything inside. And the way we did it is we didn't take out any mortgage or anything like that. When we go home on every 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, we just take the money that we have saved up and we put it in the cabin, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, The little town that we live in did have some issues when we first bought the property with some of the people that live there in town. So the first thing we did was put an alarm system on it and put security cameras outside. When we first got the property, there was a lot of wildlife. We had deer walking through the yard, just hanging out in the yard. We had fox, we had raccoon. I mean, anything you could think of, we had in the yard or walking through the yard. And we even have a bear that comes down out of the mountain down to the lake to get fish out to eat or whatever. But after we moved the cabin in there, we put the security cameras on, we were seeing, you know, all this wildlife. Well, after about 4 or 5 months or so, we stopped seeing anything. And I mean, nothing, no deer, no fox, no nothing that was coming through our yard. And we thought it was really kind of weird. And we started watching our security cameras. Well, they, for a little while there, they were every night, about 10, 11 o'clock at night, every single night, the cameras would trigger. And, like I said, I drive a truck, so I'm out on the road. So my cameras are all on Wi-Fi. So anytime the motion sensor would pick up and the cameras would start recording, I'd get a notification on my phone. Well, for a long time, I would just look at it and, you know, there would be nothing on it. So I would just, you know, write it off, whatever. Well, after a while, we got home, my wife started actually going through the videos, started watching them with the volume on the audio, and we started hearing some really, really weird things. And there's only a couple of them that you can actually hear anything really clear. One of them, like I was telling you before, the camera on the front of the house is about 10 and a half feet off the ground or so. And the other thing I need to say, we have no neighbors around us. So it's not like somebody's driving down the road and the cameras are picking them up. There's nothing around us. And in one of the videos, the motion picked up and you can't see nothing. But if you listen really close, it sounds like there's something underneath the camera and you can hear like a real low growl. And to me, it sounds almost like if you're hungry and your stomach kind of does that growl, that's kind of what it sounds like to me. And it sounds like it's coming from right underneath the camera. Like I said, it would go off like every 5 minutes. And the one right after that, you don't hear a growl, but you do see something in the camera, which to me looked like, it's going to sound kind of stupid, but to me, it looks like you can see like hair kind of swaying in like the corner of the camera or something like that, but you can't hear nothing in that one. And one of the other ones that I found really interesting, which is the one you can't hear, which I really wish you could. It picks up again and you don't see nothing, but you can hear, if you turn the volume all the way up and you listen really close from far away, and it sounds really far away on the camera, but you can hear this, I think you called it the Ohio scream or something like that. It sounds like almost like a tornado siren or, like a siren when your town tests their sirens or whatever. It sounds like that, where it's just really long and, you know, starts low and goes high and then goes back low and then goes high again. That's the only time we've ever heard it, and it's the only time we've heard it since. But the town that we live in does not have a siren, and we're far enough away from any other towns that there's no way you'd hear their sirens on our cameras. The thing about that one, as soon as it started, I think probably every dog in that town, or at least around us, just started barking crazy. It was just really, really weird. And this last summer, we decided we found this group that's down there by us. They're actually a paranormal group, but they are kind of getting into the whole cryptid thing. So we started talking to them and they came out to our property and we started walking around our property. We actually walked around more than just our property. We walked around the lake, and there's a trail that you can walk around that goes around the lake and stuff like that. But we actually found a couple what looked to be footprints on our property. And I believe Amy sent you a picture of one of them. And that one there, you can actually see the ridges in the toes, at least two of them. It's kind of in an area where there was quite a bit of like leaf litter, leaf fall, whatever. And I kind of just happened to catch it out of the corner of my eye when I kind of swept it clean, you know, got the leaf debris and stuff like that out of it. And I started really looking at it, and, you know, we took a picture of it and we sent that to you. But we did find a couple other footprints in the property. Nothing that I could say definitively is anything of substance, but we do have quite a few. Most of the trees around our property are pretty good sized trees. I think the smallest ones we have are probably 6 or 8 inches in diameter, but we have several of them that are like fresh breaks about halfway up the tree. We have a lot of them that are, they're not broke. They're just kind of bent over. And we have some that are, you know, intertwined in with the other ones that are bent over. And the other thing that we found really, really weird, which I don't think she told you about, and it could just be innocent, we don't know, but probably 150 feet or so from the back of our property line, there's this area back there that's kind of cleared out a little bit, and it's pretty heavily forested back, pretty heavily treed back there. But there's this little area that's kind of cleared out. And in this area, there was a bunch of trees that were taken down. And they were kind of, it's kind of like a, what shape would you say that is? Kind of like a circle almost, where they had pulled these trees down or cut them down or something. I don't know. But they kind of lay almost like a log cabin where they kind of stack them up. And it's probably 3 or 4 feet high. And it goes kind of in a semicircle, and there's nothing in the center of it, but it's just this circle that's made out of these trees. That's kind of one of the first things we found that when we were walking around back there, but we thought that was really weird. And like I said, it could have just been people that did that. We don't know, but they were big trees. These weren't the little 6-8 inch trees. These were a good 12-13 inch round trees. I mean, big trees. And they don't look like they were cut. If you look at the ends of them, they look almost like they were like broke. You know, I don't know if the wind just broke them or what happened, but it was definitely strange, especially with everything else we found back there.
Yeah, that is strange. And I'll go back through the Ring camera recordings that Amy sent me. It's so hard to fix audio with those Ring cams because the audio is so horrendous. I have the same setup at my house, so I know exactly what you're talking about. And they're built to take video, you know, cheap video. And they're not really meant for great audio. But I would love to see pictures of this structure that you're talking about with the trees. How often do you guys go back to this cabin?
Right now, until we get it done, about every we go home about every 3 weeks. So, yeah, about every 3 weeks. Once we get it done, which we're almost done, we're just about to get to just putting appliances in and stuff like that, then we'll be there, you know, all the time. But, yeah, right now it's every 3 weeks or so.
Well, you have to let me know when you guys go back if activity picks up, and I'll post the pictures of the tracks that you guys sent me. I ask everyone on the show, James, and I'll ask Amy here in a moment, and there's no wrong answer, but what do you think Sasquatch is? What's your take on it?
And I knew you were going to ask me that. We've been listening to you for a long time and watching other stuff, and you know, I do believe it's flesh and blood. I do believe it's intelligent. I don't know how much I buy into the Nephilim and everything else. To me, it's just another animal that's out there that hasn't been discovered yet. You know, we find new animals almost on a yearly basis. So I do believe it's flesh and blood. I do believe that they are extremely intelligent. They have to be in order to evade us like they do. I don't think I believe too much about any portals or anything like that. To me, it's just a flesh and blood animal, maybe partly the A, partly human, partly, you know, I really don't know. It's until we actually get one, nobody's really going to know. And I just think it's something that's very, very intelligent that we just haven't found yet, and they don't want us to find. And I don't know that we will ever.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair answer, James, for sure. I really appreciate you guys sharing the helicopter incident. I'd like to know what in the world was going on there. With regard to the cabin, when you guys get off the road and you go home, let me know if anything else happens. Amy, let me ask you, what do you think Sasquatch is? And again, there's no wrong answer.
Well, I have a little bit more different opinion than my husband does. I kind of think that it's more of a humanoid. I think they're intelligent. I think that there is a lot more aspect to them than what anybody knows. And I don't think that they are just animals. You know, for this to be able to hide, and some of the structures that you've seen or that people post about and stuff like that, you've got to have a lot more intelligent than just the great ape. And so I think they're more of a humanoid. I can't say that there's really actually a supernatural, a paranormal aspect to them. Most times the logical thought of what something is actually the truth. So I don't really know that I can buy into the alien connection to them or anything like that, but I do think they are more human than what we give them credit for.
Yeah, it's really hard to nail down what they are. And, you know, when people say it's an animal like James, I get it. A lot of their behavior, a lot of even their appearance seems to be very animal-like. But in the same breath, a lot of their behavior, there seems to be a humanity in them, more than just an animal. And, you know, when I ask people, what is it that you saw? They'll say somewhere between a gorilla and a man. You know, there was very much human characteristics in the face. So it's hard to argue both points. It's a really strange topic because generally you would just argue one way or another. And in this situation, with this topic, you could kind of argue both ways. I really appreciate you coming forward and sharing the helicopter incident and then some of these pictures and what's going on at the cabin. And I would love to know if anything else happens. But thank you so much, Amy and James, for taking the time to come on.
Well, I appreciate you contacting me. You know, what you do by getting these stories out there, I think is a...
We're going to end it there because we got to sell the station, kiddies. We got to sell the station. Thanks to Wes over at Sasquatch Chronicles. That is episode 937, the helicopter incident where a husband and wife, a trucking team, apparently saw some bears and, you know, Bigfoot, and they got a cabin and all that stuff. This is This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday here on Revolution Radio, located at revolution.radio. Your favorite internet browser, common spelling. If you wish to donate, kiddies, what I want you to do is head over to the link I just threw in the room. It is the donations tab from the home website. You can become a patron. There's a donor box option, direct payment North America only. We have some cryptocurrency options as well. If you are interested in hosting your own award-winning program, this is the link. I know you want to comment. This is the link to the schedules, Studio A as well as Studio B. You find the open studio. You find some time blocks. What you do then is you click on the link I am fixing, as my grandfather would say. What happened here? Fixing fixing. Hang on, something just happened. Get too excited. Fixin' to pop into the chat room. It is the contact tab. Can somebody please change the tabs where if you click on them, they open in a separate window? Can somebody do that for me, please? I'm watching you too, Comet. Here you can click on the contact tab after you've looked at the schedules. Get a hold of a Mad Painter. Get a hold of Mr. Rowe, my favorite host, who comes up next. Get a hold of Lady Horse. Tell them who you are, the time block, the studio, the type of program you have. What you will then be required to do is download Skype and then have a meeting with the host review team that I am still waiting for my professional official invite from. Ro, I look exactly like the Bigfoot in the lower left-hand corner. That is a true depiction of what I look like. However, I have a little salt and pepper fur. So, the donations tab, the schedule tab, the contact tab, the tabs that you need, all located at revolution.radio. Remember, we are 100% listener-supported, and all that jazzy, jazzy, jazzy. Mr. Rowe, my favorite host, comes up next. Reality Extraction. Have yourself a fabulous that Bigfoot has good. Yeah, well, Bigfoot's got something, kiddies. Have a fabulous weekend. We will talk with you on Monday in the words of Katie Couric. Good night, y'all.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law, spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.